Our study tonight is out of Nahum chapter 3, the whole chapter, verses 1 through 19. God's comforting news of vengeance on formidable, abusive parties. We've found in our study through the book of Nahum, the Old Testament prophet Nahum, his name actually means comfort. And this is a message of comfort to the people of Judah who were terrified of their arch foe. This arch foe was the Assyrians, and their capital city was Nineveh. The Assyrians were known as the terrorist nation of the ancient world. They were brutal. They actually terrorized people. They would torture people for sport. To them, war was something that was a sport. They were horrendous that way. No wonder when God wanted Jonah to go to Nineveh and to preach and to have the people repent, Jonah didn't want to do that. You know, he wanted them to be judged. But God, in his tremendous mercy, sent him to them, and they repented. And the book of Nahum is written 100 years later because the Ninevites went back to their old ways, their ways of brutality. So God says, all right, enough. And it's a book of judgment, which is a comfort to Judah. And this is why he is announcing, Nahum is preaching this and proclaiming this to Israel. So trusting God to take vengeance on an abusive party may seem like a simple, attainable task for one who has been moderately abused. But cases of extreme abuse are far more difficult for the victims to handle. I know a person who is in their 80s today, right now. They were abusively treated when this person was a small child. They still haven't handled it fully adequately. It's been traumatic because, you know, when that happens when you're 5, 6 years of age, it's something that you don't get over. Well, Nahum chapter 3, 1 to 19 provided Israel with the comforting prediction of God's vengeance on a terribly abusive foe in Nineveh, and it offers comfort and direction for similarly afflicted folk today. Now, we have to keep in mind as we go through this that Romans chapter 12, verse 19 quotes a passage out of Deuteronomy that says that vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay. We never have the right to take vengeance. But that doesn't mean vengeance is wrong. God is the perfect avenger because he is extremely objective. He cares about all people, even those whom he has to judge and administer vengeance on. But vengeance is something that is a just thing. It is therefore a wholesome thing. But when God takes vengeance, it is always right, it is always balanced and effective. Well, we have a message here of God's comforting news of vengeance on formidable abusive parties. In Nahum chapter 3, verse 1, God's prophet Nahum pronounced a woe on Israel's formidable abusive foe in Nineveh, noting several vile characteristics about its abuse that would lead to God's severe judgment on the city. Let me read the verse. Nahum chapter 3, verse 1, woe to the city of bloodshed, literally. It is all full of lies and plunder. The prey does not cease. Let me stop right there. Nineveh was a city of bloodshed, a cruel foe, so it would fall due to such infamous abuse. The way they would treat their prisoners of war or the people that they were attacking, the things that they would do to them, I can't repeat in a circumstance right here, but they were just absolutely vicious. Also, Nineveh was full of lies. This is a city that would manipulatively pretend to befriend other nations in order to gain control of them so as to plunder them. The Ninevites would lie. They would say, oh, sure. And they'd send an entourage out, and they would say, sure, we'll be helpful. We'll be friendly to you. You make a pact with us. And so they'd make a pact with them. The Ninevites would move in, and then they would plunder the city just to take advantage of them. So they lied. They constantly lied as a way of life. And this is typical of people who are manipulative. They will lie. They will deceive. They'll misread and cause people to be misread and so forth simply because they use their words and their lies to get a foot in the door to take advantage. But to them, an extremely abusive person, deceit is a vehicle that they use for their own ends. They don't adhere to truth as though truth has any real intrinsic value. That's one of the marks, incidentally, of an abusive party. Then Nineveh never lacked victims, indicating that she relentlessly abused other people. That's why it says in the end of verse 1, the prey departs not, the prey ceases not. It's Assyria lived by plundering others and did this on a perpetual basis. She never got tired of this. It was a way of life. Well, having itemized these terrible characteristics, in Nahum chapter 3, verses 2 and 3, God described the dramatic battle scenes that would occur as the Medes and the Babylonians invaded Nineveh and destroyed her for her sins. Let me just read that. The noise of a whip, the noise of the rattling of the wheels, these would be the chariot wheels, and of the prancing horses and the jumping chariots. The horseman lifts up both the bright sword and the glittering spear, and there is a multitude of slain and a great number of bodies. There is no end to their corpses. They stumble upon their corpses. This is interesting because this is what the Ninevites would do. They would actually, when they would kill people, they would pile them up in piles, sort of decorating the landscape. And the Bible predicts here that this would happen to them. What they had been doing to city after city after city would happen to them. And remember, in the ancient Near East, what happens to the body after death is almost as important as to what happens to the body before death. And in fact, in many Middle Eastern countries today, it's the same way. Well, the fall of Nineveh is figuratively likened to the traumatic abuse of a harlot in Nahum chapter 3, 4 through 7. The city had spiritually prostituted herself from practicing witchcraft for demonic insight into defeating other nations. So God would let other nations invade, plunder, and destroy and dishonor her, with no one grieving her fall. Verse 4, because of the multitude of the whoredoms of the well-favored harlot, the mistress of witchcrafts, and selleth nations through her whoredoms and families through her witchcrafts. It's incidentally, witchcraft and the occult are often seen as adultery because people are interacting with demons when they should be interacting with God. So this is seen as spiritual adultery. Verse 5, behold, I am against thee, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will discover or lift your skirts up over your face, and I will show the nations your nakedness and the kingdoms thy shame. And I will cast abominable filth upon you and make you vile and will set you as a gazing stock. And it shall come to pass that all they that look upon thee shall flee away from you and say, Nineveh is laid waste. Who will bemoan her? When shall I seek comforters for you? In other words, there's not going to be anyone left who's actually going to lament the fall of this huge city. Remember, Nineveh was a city of about 200,000 people. Huge. And so this is a devastating destruction. It's like the fall of Hartford or something. You know, it's just huge, huge event that occurred in that particular part of the world in that era. Well, Nineveh had destroyed the city of Thebes along the Nile River, an event that is recalled by God in Nahum chapter 3, verses 8 to 11. But God would turn the tables on Nineveh, letting the city herself experience the very cruelties that she administered on Thebes, and Nineveh's own coming fall to the Medes and the Babylonians. For example, God had asked Nineveh if she thought she was better than the city of Thebes that she had defeated in verse 8. Are you better than the populace? No, and that's actually, a better translation would be Thebes. Hebrew is No Amon. It's the capital of Upper Egypt, which was sacked by the Assyrians in 663 B.C. That was situated among the rivers, that had the waters round about, whose rampart was the sea, and her wall was from the sea. Dr. Ryrie, in his footnote, says that Thebes, like Nineveh, Thebes, like Nineveh, was situated among the rivers, or located on a river. And in Thebes' case, the river was the Nile, where you had the Kosa River in Nineveh. And when you have to cross bodies of water to attack a city, you leave yourself vulnerable because you're trying to negotiate the water. When you're vulnerable to the attack of the people in the defending city. So it was seen as a tremendous advantage to have a canal or a moat going around the city at that particular time, which practice was carried over into Europe during the Middle Ages. That's why they had moats to keep the people away. Well, anyway, like the people of Thebes, many Ninevites would be taken captive and go into exile. I'm getting ahead of myself here. Thebes had been located on the Nile, surrounded by canal waters, making her seemingly difficult to defeat, much like Nineveh was aided by its association river. And like Nineveh, who looked to her vassal states for military help, Thebes had relied on Somaliland and Libya, but to no avail. This comes out in verses 9 and 10. Ethiopia and Egypt were her strength, and it was infinite. Put, which is Somaliland, and Lubim, or Libya, were your helpers. Yet she was carried away. She went into captivity. Her young children also were dashed to pieces at the intersection of all the streets, and they cast lots for her honorable men, and all her great men were bound in chains. This is a typical practice of the Assyrians. They would destroy the infants, first of all, to break the morale of the people that they were conquering, but also to destroy the future generation of that city so those people would not want to come back and rebuild it. So they would take all the young children or the infants and so forth and brutally slay them this way. And they would do it at the street intersections where the people would congregate, and this was designed to devastate the people. It was a terrorist nation, there's no question about it. It was absolutely ruthless. It's amazing that God put up with the people of Nineveh as long as he did. You know, you look at the God of the Old Testament, he's very long-suffering. There's no question about it. Well, however, just as Thebes had fallen to Nineveh, Nineveh would fall to her attackers. Like the people of Thebes, many Ninevites would be taken captive and go into exile. We read that in verse 10. Yet she was carried away, she went into captivity. And like Thebes, whose infants had been dashed to pieces at every intersection, the word street, head, means actually the intersection, to end its future, Nineveh's infants would likewise be similarly slain. And then like Thebes, whose nobles and great men had been divided up by lot to enemy soldiers and chained up as slaves, the same humiliating fate would befall the prominent men of Nineveh. The latter part of verse 10, they cast lots for her honorable men, and all her great men were bound in chains. In our culture, being defamed in public is not as big an issue. In the Middle East, even to this day, being publicly defamed is almost worse than death. China and Japan suffer the same thing. Being publicly humiliated is almost worse than death itself. So this was seen as a horrible situation in that culture. Now, as the men of Thebes had been drunk in her fall, the men of Nineveh would be drunk in her fall. And that is prophesied in verse 11. Thou also shalt be drunken. There's a secular historian by the name of Diodorus Siculus, who lived at about 20 BC. And he actually noticed that a lot of the soldiers were drunk at that time when the enemy Medes and the Babylonians came and invaded. So this is a prophecy that was literally fulfilled. And then God predicted the men of Nineveh would go into hiding. Notice the latter part of verse 11. Thou shalt be hid. Thou also shalt seek strength because of the enemy. What happened is when the city fell, the king was able to flee, and he tried to gather people around him in another location. But so many people were afraid of the Medes and the Babylonians that eventually the remaining Ninevites just dispersed, and they started intermarrying with the people that were around them. In fact, it was such a long time that people were trying to stay away, or the people of Nineveh were staying away from the city of Nineveh, that the city, the location of the city of Nineveh was actually lost until it was discovered in 1842 by archaeologists. So the fact that thou shalt be hid may actually apply to the city itself. In 1842, remember, this church was built in 1848, just 6 years after the rediscovery of Nineveh. So that was quite a long period of time. Now, other descriptions of Nineveh's fall in Nahum chapter 3, 12 through 19 include the easy prey of her military fortresses would become, the demoralizing of her troops, the opening and destruction of her protective sluice gates and city gates, her failure to rebuild destroyed portions of her protective brick walls, the defeat and scattering of her surviving soldiers, the permanence of the fall and the joy of other nations, which joy would be the result of Nineveh's having been so perpetually cruel towards them. Let me just read those verses, verses 12 through 19. All your strongholds shall be like fig trees with the first ripe figs. If they be shaken, they shall even fall to the mouth of the eater. Behold, your people in the midst of thee are women. The soldiers actually be women as far as their fear and their inability to fight. The gates of your land shall be set wide open unto your enemies. The fire shall devour your bars. Draw thee waters for the siege. Fortify your strongholds. Go to clay and tread the mortar. Make strong the kiln. They're trying to rebuild the parts of the walls that have been battered down by the enemy. There shall the fire devour you. The sword shall cut you off. It shall eat you up like the cankerworm. Make yourself as many as the cankerworm. Make yourself as many as the locusts. You have multiplied your merchants above the stars of heaven. The cankerworm spoils and flees away. Your crowned are as the locusts, and your captains as the great grasshoppers, which camp on the hedges in the cold day, but when the sun rises, they flee away, and their place is not known. where they are. And that's exactly what happened. The soldiers ended up just dispersing and fleeing. Your shepherds slumber, reference to the death of these men. O king of Assyria, your nobles shall dwell in the dust. Your people are scattered upon the mountains and nobody gathers them. There's no healing of your bruise. Your wound is grievous. All that hear the fall of you shall clap their hands over you. For upon whom has not your wickedness passed continually? And you'll notice how the emphasis there at the end, this emphasis on the, it's a last parting shot at Nineveh's predominant sin, the perpetual terrible abuse of other nations. So it's interesting that God was very, very gracious and long-suffering toward the people of Nineveh. But when the hammer fell of God's judgment, he obliterated the nation with the capital city, the fall of the capital city, and it has ceased to exist. You don't find Assyrians today. All the Assyrian peoples that survived actually intermarried with the people in Iran, in Iraq, Kuwait, and so forth. They just dispersed out. So the lesson is God comforted Israel with the prediction that a relentless, deceptive, manipulative, and even demonic-influenced foe, demonic-influenced because she sought help by means of witchcraft, Nineveh would be destroyed in divine vengeance in a way that fit her abuse. So, if badly mistreated by a very formidable, abusive party, may we trust God to deal with the party, taking hope and encouragement from the message of Nahum chapter 3, 1-19 to that end. And once again, I refer to Romans chapter 12, 19. The Bible says, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay." So if your enemy hunger, feed him, and so forth. And in that way, you'll heap coals of fire upon his head. The implication is let the Lord handle it. It's interesting, I referred in the morning sermon this morning to Mark Robinson's book. He's written the book, Smoke, Fire, and Angels, about the 2005 catastrophic Avon Mountain crash. Remember, that's where that truck... It was a runaway truck and came down the hill, didn't have any brakes and so forth. And he mentions the tremendous injustice of it all because the company owner, the Wilcox, who owned that fleet of trucks, had over 1,100 violations. They'd been cited by the police, 1,100 violations, and yet the state was still giving them $1.6 million worth of contracts. So he felt that the state was culpable, and I did too, but there's a law in the books that says that the state can't be culpable if there's someone else that is culpable like Mr. Wilcox. So Mr. Wilcox is sitting in jail, and the state gets off. That's because of a law that we have. But the state really hasn't done anything to help the victims' families, and I really believe it should. And when the state of Minnesota, remember they had that bridge collapse? The state of Minnesota backed up and started and gave, I forget how much money, but they gave money to the victims' families and the victims that were there. But the state of Connecticut has not helped these other people. So he's written this book, Mark has. He was one of the people who was injured, but he survived. He's an ING insurance agent, Mark is. And he's written, and the proceeds of the book, 100% of the proceeds are going to the victims' families. So he's doing his best to help out in this situation. And as you read the book, you can see he's frustrated at the injustice of this all. But you know, I do know that there is a day coming when God is going to even the score even on that situation. Because in eternity, God takes care of all of that. What we ought to do is to make sure that when we're driving down the road, if we see a truck that is old, or that is worn, or that we know has something out of whack. We know the brakes, we can smell the brakes smoking or something, or the driver is driving erratically. As I warned the people in the worship service this morning, steer clear of it. And if it's something that we know that they're violating the law, we need to call the police. The police, incidentally, are very, especially the state police, are very, very heightened, very sensitive to this, and they'll look the truck up and the owner up. And if they have to, they'll pull their insurance or their license or whatnot so as to not hurt other people. But on top of that, we have to keep in mind that God allowed. The Bible tells us in Revelation chapter 1 that Jesus Christ is the one who allows deaths to occur, and he has the keys of Hades and of death as to what happens to the soul when they die too. So he allowed that thing to occur. And I know when I look at that accident, I think the accident I had in 1990 when I almost died. I had 6 broken ribs, a collapsed lung, a ruptured spleen. Happened in Torrington, over at Torringford Street and New Harmington or Harmington Road. right there at that intersection. And the Lord used that to direct me to be more motivated than ever to minister His Word, because I don't know how many days I have left. So we all ought to just leave the wrongs that are done to the Lord, but use what time and what opportunity we have left to serve Him. And if we see a wrong that is done, make sure that we're not doing wrong, and do everything we can to help other people.